So in terms of background here, as you many of you know, there's been a large literature on economics over the last couple of decades, dealing with social networks and social networks in labor markets in particular. There are some nice early reviews. There's been an enormous proliferation in research using theories about network architecture, using new tools that allow you to sort of map networks very carefully. I'm not going to get into that. I'm going to have a sort of a much more simple story to tell, but hopefully one that can be of interest. So a starting point here that Kunal also was involved in, working on in an earlier paper, is this idea that economists tended to focus on the supply side when trying to understand network effects. So one saw sort of networks largely as a source of information about labor market opportunities. A particularly powerful representation of that, which came much earlier, of course, is in sociology, is Mark Granovetter's idea about the usefulness of weak ties. Having many people that you're weakly connected to provides a chance to get access to a lot of information about different job openings. And then the idea is that is very useful during a job search process. A similar sort of line of reasoning about information and the usefulness of information for job search is made in a JD paper by Jacqueline Vava and Yves Senot, suggesting that vacancy information correlates with population density, and having access to this type of information is particularly useful at the bottom of the occupational ladder, because workers there are illiterate or semi-literate, and the information that you get through your networks then substitutes for information that you may get through other channels. If you think about this sort of slightly outside the network frame also, there's a quite recent paper by Oster and Miller-Steinberg, also in JDE, on the impact of proximity to IT centers and what that does to the demand for schooling. And the idea here is essentially that, you know, there's more information, more knowledge about job opportunities at their higher end of the labor market, and that then sort of stimulates the demand for education. So what I'm interested here, what we're interested in this paper, is more about different types of network mechanisms. So this information dispersing role is an example of that. So if we sort of have as a starting point here, think about orthodox models of rural urban migration, Harris Todaro type of framework, for instance, a question here is whether labor markets are level playing fields. If they are level playing fields, then any sort of efforts to stimulate livelihoods diversification or social mobility through the sort of non-farm urbanization manufacturing type of route can easily be promoted by simply providing information to those who are candidates for jobs, so that they are aware of these employment opportunities. On the other hand, if there's something else going on in terms of what networks do, this can become more intricate. So there may be access restriction here, and the question then is whether that's across the board or only in some labor markets or jobs. So what one has to ask then is why that should be. What explains that kind of access restrictions? Now I'm floating around, which I promise not to do. So I'll stay within this same field. Okay, so you know, if you think about what we're all familiar with here, ideas about family labor in agricultural production, for instance. What's the advantage of family labor? The advantage is, of course, that you don't run into too many motivational problems in terms of monitoring requirements and otherwise. Again, I'm sort of mentioning another paper by Kunal here, which is done with Banerjee and Natarajan, and where you have a sort of a parallel in the manufacturing sector, right? So the question for small enterprises, and the orthodox question that economists ask is, what is it that constrains small enterprises from growing? So one constraint that we're all familiar with is of course related to credit, but there's also something about expansion that means that you have to start hiring in labor out from outside the family. So from moving from being a family firm to hiring labor from outside is not always that straightforward. It introduces monitoring requirements that are not necessarily there when you hire your own folks. Another issue here that's important and that we sort of talk about in our paper is also the limited scope for contract enforcement. Think about informality, jobs, job contracts and their absence. What do you do as an employer here to try to control or try to ensure that workers are productive, that they show up and so forth? This has also been hinted at in Kaivan Munshi and Mark Rosenzweig paper in AER, which looks at this issue of referrals and manufacturing employment, other types of employment, and also how that then curtails investments in schooling in the new generation, because the new generation is channeled into the same type of occupations that their parents or fathers held. Here, simple statistic, you're all familiar with that. I know that Unavider is doing a lot of useful work on informality. 86% of India's manufacturing workers employed in 17 million small and informal enterprises, while the remainder, 14%, are working for a much smaller number of formal enterprises. So informalization is a big issue. Now, if you think about this a little bit more carefully in terms of what the implications might be for what migration looks like, we would have to think about, or at least sort of be open to think about, migration as a sort of a chain phenomenon. This map that I borrowed from one of my former colleagues, a young economist at Indian Institute of Management, and the point here is essentially that, you know, you get, instead of migration flows responding to incentives through the labor market and wages and so forth, you have migration corridors that persist over time and where networks at the source end and destination end become very important for understanding where people move to. So it's instead of moving to the area where you might get the highest expected wage in a sort of Harris Todaro sense, you instead follow these corridors of time. So the Indian map, if you look at the Indian map, it's full of these type of corridors. You have high migration areas here in Ratnagiri, Udupi. You have migrants going from Odisha to Surat in Gujarat. And you have sort of high pockets of out-migration from various parts of the country. And if you look at how and where people move to, you see sort of similar propensity. So this is Mumbai. These are this sort of kitchen towel field here. Are the areas with highest out-migration to Mumbai. And you can see that much of that migration comes from within Maharashtra itself. But there's also pockets here, in eastern UP, in parts of Gujarat, in Rajasthan, and so forth. And if you look at Delhi, it's different because the migrants there come mainly from sort of the vicinity of Delhi, but then also from Bihar and eastern UP. And what you get is sort of corridors of a kind that's usually not particularly consistent with how we normally think about rural-urban migrations and incentives for this. Challenge here is that, as we've also sort of discussed in this earlier paper, is that there's, of course, a whole sort of array of candidate explanations for why chain migration may occur, and filtering out one over the other and focusing on particular mechanisms related to networks here is of course something that then becomes quite difficult. If we look at evidence of referrals, as we call it in our title, there's interesting data in Munshi and Rosenzweig again, and what they say essentially is that referral into blue-collar jobs in Mumbai 68% among males, 44% in white-collar jobs. But the definition here is a little problematic because it's somewhat vague. So what they say essentially here is that 68% of the working class men received help from a relative or member of the community in finding their first job. So this is a relatively loose definition of referral. Now, if you look at the World Bank, data from the World Bank's micro-enterprise survey for India of 2006, about 1,500 small enterprises covered. Between, depends a little bit on the sector, 40 and 65% of the most recent hires were recruited through the social network of someone already working in the firm. Yeah.
So you showed us the maps.
Yeah.
So to what extent is the migration explained by the wage differential across the geographical areas? Only after that would network, etc., would be important, right? So the first order effect would be
wage differential. That's how you think about it, right? You think about the sort of the wage as the main driver here. But that depends on how the labor markets operate, right? I'm going to say more about this, so we'll talk about it. I mean, it's a good point, but let's get to it in a little while, yeah? Once I'm done with my part of the story. So also, there's a nice experiment in Beeman and Magruder, 2012. So in their sample from Kolkata, 45% of employees had helped a friend or relative find a job, again with their current employer. So there's science here that this is important. You know, you not only need to know someone in the city, but you actually need to know someone within the workplace where you end up finding a job. Other work of a similar kind, Heath studies referral into garment factories in Bangladesh, and Fashams and Moradi have a paper on employee referrals in the Ghanaian army. Okay, so why, if this is important, if actually entering a workplace through someone already there is important, what could explain this? What kind of sort of theoretical mechanisms have been proposed? So there are quite a few of them. So there's one particularly influential, perhaps, where there's a screening explanation for referral. And the idea here is essentially that if you look at networks and if you look at current employees, employers have an incentive to tap into the networks of particularly productive, particularly talented current employees, but that builds on the assumption that these networks comprise of similar type of individuals. So indeed, individuals with similar qualities. So then you get a screening effect of referral, screening explanation for referral. Kugler has a paper which argues that there's a moral hazard explanation here. So what you can achieve by recruiting referral, and the mechanism that sort of comes out of this is not too dissimilar from this, because again, there's an emphasis on productive employees. But the assumption here is that this productive employee will then act as a role model for the person that's brought in, and the effort of this person that's brought in will emulate the effort of this productive employee. And that means that you can reduce your monitoring cost. Then there's another paper by Simon and Warner, where the idea is that referral can improve the recruit and workplace map. So you're able to find someone who's a better fit with the workplace by using an insider who has obviously a better understanding of what is required. And that then can be beneficial because it can, for instance, bring down the level of labor turnover. And then there's another one here, more recent, also in JD, more general. But there's also sort of possible nepotism here, of course, because somebody may be tempted to bring in a relative who's not that productive, but who may gain from bringing in this relative because it gives the person other advantages. And this can then sort of be counterproductive for the firm. And then there's another one where you can think about the motivation here as being sort of more social, and working with a friend or a close acquaintance can be gainful for you, but needs not be gainful for the employer. Okay, so what we try to do here is to sort of wade into this terrain. I'm trying to sort of use our understanding and different types of evidence to develop an alternative explanation and a set of predictions around this. So what we have here, what we use here, I'm going to be very, very quick and very summary on the theory part, but the intuition is simple. It's very easy to follow, so I'm going to sort of get you on that. So a firm can recruit either through the market or through employee referral. And what we do here, because what we said here is that there might be something about labor markets that's differentiated in terms of whether this channel in is required or not, whether there's a case for arguing that there is such a channel in or not. And that may vary across different types of jobs or different pockets of the labor market. So what we do here is to focus partly on... So we link referral to the cost of worker optimism, and this sort of, as I said, can vary by job type. We've also focused on referee stakes, which is important because it really sort of has to do with whether the referee will act in the interests of the employer or not. And then we endogenize referee incentives and then the social tie between this referee and recruit. And then we provide some analysis of the incentives here, playing around with different assumptions about this one. So essentially, so what we have here is an efficiency wage. And this C here is cost of optimism. This is the employee's share, the benefit to the employee of behaving optimistically. And this is the Q, which is monitoring technology and captures the probability of being caught. This is quite a general formulation. The main point here is about this referral efficiency wage. So there are two elements here that we need to sort of account for. The first is this efficiency wage that you would pay under normal circumstances. And this is the gain from recruiting through referral. There are two elements here, the rho and the R. So this one is the strength of the social tie between the referee and the recruit. And this here, R, captures the referee's stature in the workplace. His accumulated goodwill, if you want, right? So the stronger the stake that this referee has in the workplace, the greater the gain to the employer from recruiting through referral becomes. Okay? Because you can save on your incentive provision costs from relying on the tie between the referee and the recruit and the stakes that the referee has in the workplace. Okay, so that's the idea here is essentially that there's a way here to provide a cheaper incentive mechanism through this referral channel. And then there's referee incentives that come in addition, because there are gains to the referee also, because there's social stature to be gained in his or her social networks, and there may also be some side payments. And then there's a sort of the added benefit that can accrue and add to this from increasing the goodwill with the employer. Okay, so what do we get out of this that's different? First of all, if you look at the literature on networks, there's a lot of emphasis on weak ties and their value. So what we get here is different, because what the prediction, main prediction here is of a strong social tie between the referee and the recruit. Now, we talked about this stake already, right? So what you want to make sure here as an employer, if this mechanism is to work, is that you invite a staff member a member of your staff to act as referee, who has a very high stake in the performance of this person that's brought in. Okay? If there's no stake there, why should the person bother? All right.
So R is the decision variable for the firm, is it?
Huh?
Capital R is...
No, the R is the accumulated goodwill of the referee. Right, so if you think about a person who is working for a firm, right? You earn up goodwill, you earn up stature as an employee, right? So what you need to ensure as an employer is a person, that there's a person here who is an insider, but who has sort of genuine interests in the performance of himself and of the firm going forward.
Right. So in the model, the firm's problem is to hire through conventional means or through referral. Is that the firm's problem?
Yeah.
So then what is the decision variable for the firm in the model?
So the firm here will have to act, will have to choose whom to act as act as the referee, right? So that's one. And then the other one is that the firm then has an interest in who the referee chooses to recruit. And it's optimal here for the firm to ensure that there's a strong social tie here between the referee and the recruit. Yeah. So it has to choose the contract. Is it recruiting through the market or through the referral mechanism? When will it choose the referral mechanism? It will choose the referral mechanism when there are employees of this kind available that you can rely on, that have this accumulated goodwill. And then you will have to then sort of entrust that person to choose someone who has the characteristics that you're looking for, and this is sort of secured through then the choice of the strong tie. So what we do here is that we get sort of efficiency wages as a choice when the costs of opportunism are sufficiently high and exceed the threshold. Okay, another thing that we get, which is interesting and which follows from this expression here, of course, is that you, compared to when you recruit to other through other channels here, the efficiency wage is lower when you recruit through referral. So there's actually a referral wage penalty. And that's very different from many of these other explanations, as we should see. So I'll come to this as well. Okay. So now sort of to our approach here to looking at this empirically. And if you think about the part of this network, the part of this literature on social networks, it's been quite strongly influenced by a paper by Kaivan Munshi in QG in 2003, which looked at Mexico-US migration, and where the sort of the whole main story is about the IV that he uses, which is now very familiar, of course, because what he does is to use rainfall patterns at the source end as to identify network effects at the destination end. And essentially what he ends up with, of course, is that that he is able to identify network effects, but he's also not able to say much about what kind of mechanisms that are actually in operation. So the patterns that he observes become then sort of guesswork in terms of whether this is really a referral or something else or just information. I mean, having a destination network is advantageous for labor market outcomes at destination. But why and through sort of what means this actually operates, he has no information about. So there's no data on that. He only shows that the networks are advantageous for labor market outcomes. And the rest is, in a way, guesswork. So what we do here is to be much more pragmatic and much less focused on identification. We try to sort of construct a story that seemed to be sensible based on what our theory says and what our data shows. So what we do here, partly, is to draw a little bit on the very rich ethnographic literature that exists on India. This is based on evidence of referrals, and I would say that in a way, if you want to understand incentives in labor markets in India, it's much better to read the ethnographic literature than to read what economists have to say, because these guys I mean, Mark Holmstrom, who's a former colleague, by the way, had figured this out, you know, 30 years before any of these economists started thinking about these issues, right? So essentially, so what he says here is very much about moral hazard and how recruitment is organized, and I'm just going to read it out very quickly. You can read it yourself. It's a generally accepted policy among managers to accept laborers on recommendation and as groups. The managers of the above-mentioned factories could tell me how everyone, each one of their workers from 12 to 35, had been introduced. They really prefer to utilize these personal relationships because it gives them a much stronger grip on their laborers. When one man misbehaves, I'll hold the one who introduced him responsible, and that man will keep the mischief maker in check, said one manager. It's not atypical. If you also look at industrial history, there are quite a few interesting parallels, and if there are sort of any deep readers of industrial history, I'm not going to claim to be among them, but these are some sort of observations along similar lines. So early industrial revolutions, huge absenteeism problem on the factory floor, and big issues about work attendance. And this is something very similar, again, that Holmstrom also picks up on, this idea of stable workers, very coveted and seen as attractive by employers. If you go back to the US, early 1900s, very, very high turnovers, not unusual with sort of these ranges. So you have your turnover your workforce several times a year. And if you look at what we observe here, about 30% of new recruits are left within 6 months of joining their new workplace. And I've seen quite a lot of this in sort of small enterprises that I've been acquainted with, that, you know, you go in one day and come back 2 weeks later and there's no one left. So that this is really often an issue. Also, there's a very interesting paper by Blattman and Durkheim, which was preceded by an article in New York Times, and where they sort of describe how surprised they were to find that factory jobs in that the big problem with entry into factory jobs in Ethiopia was that people very often didn't stay put. This was thought to be sort of a very attractive form of employment, but they had huge problems with retaining workers quite soon after they had joined. So what do we have here to offer? Well, in the sort of the world of where large data sets are becoming very common, what we have to offer is perhaps not so much in that sense, but maybe we have some depth that may be useful and that we can still learn something from. So what we did here was to do a study in Bijnor district in UP. The reason for choosing Bijnor, which is, by the way, those of you familiar with the sort of Indian setting, is not too far from Moradabad, where another famous village, where a particularly famous village is located, and from which some of the sort of the best and most interesting panel data on changes over time has been captured through repeated visits Palampuria. Okay, so we have an area that's not too dissimilar, and very rich sociological literature. We tried to sort of sample to capture religious caste and other diversity here, and then we did our own samples because the voter lists were totally messed up. And you just couldn't use them for much at all. And then we have done all these in-depth interviews with migrants about their whole sort of working life careers. We managed to trace a lot of them after repeated visits and also visiting some of the areas where they are now based. So what we have here is, in terms of descriptives, you have three main groups here, or you have sort of Muslim Ansaris. These are sort of former Julahas, so they used to be weavers. And then the Chamals, which are scheduled castes. And then there's others, including Jats, who are the main landowners in this area. So what we see here, which is interesting, is of course that there's signs here of some really sort of strong networking going on. in terms of the destination or the destination. The first employment sector that people end up with. And also, if I showed you the area destinations, there's quite a lot of variation. It's also quite young migration here, and some variation in the level of schooling and so forth. Okay, so what we did, since we did these individual histories, is that there's also a huge range across when the first labor migration occurred, covering all the way here up till recent times, starting in 1960. And we have, when we did, I've done regressions here, we've tried to sort of capture as much as possible in terms of filtering out that variation. Okay. So one thing to note, which I think is very simple, but really sort of also quite compelling, is that we often think of migration as a sort of, well, I think that's because we grew up with Haro Stolaro. We think about it maybe in the wrong way. Okay, so the idea here is that there's someone in the village who does a wage calculation in the head, and then the expected wage goes up there, and off I set, and then I embark on a sort of a job search, right? But if you think about a poor rural setting, that's not very logical. The reason for that is, of course, that the job search process itself is everything but trivial. You know, you have to go to somewhere, and then you have to find a job, which may take you a long time, or not so long time, depending on. But it's certainly not a straightforward issue. And what, of course, you see here, and this is a sort of a poor rural setting, is that people move, but they move after they got the job. And that's pretty much across the board. So you leave the village when you have a job. You have a job organized for you. 90% of these migrants left the village for their first job after they had a secured job. And then the sort of those who go for search, much smaller, and a much smaller percentage here. So those who then move into a workplace where they already know someone who's organized the job for them, and it's not through sort of somebody else, is adds up to about 60%, a little over 60% of these cases. So it's a high number. So who are these others? Who are these helpers already in the workplace? So own household members are important, but other relatives too. And here you may try to shoot me down, because other relatives is a very vague term. So that could mean just about anything. It could also mean that in the Indian context, there's a lot of ethnographic work on so-called fictive kin. So people call each other, use all kinds of relative terms. Everyone is an uncle or auntie or other things. And one tries to sort of establish these kinship terms if it's somehow beneficial. So what we were, of course, aware of this in advance, so we've done a very careful job. So these are close relatives. So it's sort of in-laws and at most cousins, that's the most distant. So it's a very high percentage then of what we call strong ties, right? So the weak ties, the friends and acquaintances and so forth here, and this one, these add up to much smaller numbers in terms of the overall, so around 17-18%. Okay, so what kind of jobs are we looking at here? And this is also going to be a little bit surprising, I think. Because if you look at the job patterns here, we're going to make some comparisons between the jobs of those who were referees, so were the workplace referees, and the migrants themselves. So what we've done here is to try to sort of differentiate between enterprise owners, which is part of it, professionals, skilled-less, vendors who are sort of self-employed, and may be selling fruit, may be selling bakery products, other things, and so forth. And then those who are in apprentice jobs, and those who are sort of semi-skilled, and then this is the bottom category of hard manual, low status labor, right at the bottom here. Okay. So what we do now is to, because obviously if you want to run with these categories, there's going to be a lot of scope for juggling between these different here, and very hard to make clear-cut separation and definitions that are meaningful. So what I'm doing here, what we're doing here, is to make all the top categories, skill categories, into one. So we call that group one. And then group two here are these 6 and 7, and then the bottom is 8 and 9. Okay, so what you have here, if you look at the referees and the migrants themselves, the first migrant jobs, that's a huge contrast, right? So what would you expect here? If you had pure information story, what would you expect about who these referees would be in the workplace? This was all about dispersion of information and vacancy information. You would expect people in similar jobs who knew that there's a vacancy here to share that information around, and then that entering through that route would be very straightforward. Yeah? So these guys, first of all, it's important to notice where these people, the first migrant jobs are these two bottom categories, right? So that accounts for sort of 78% of the first migrants' jobs, which is what you would expect in a sort of a setting like this, where there's a lot of unskilled, relatively low-educated labor. Yeah?
But it's quite intuitive, right? Because the matching friction is much lower for category 2 and 3. So I don't necessarily, as an employer, I don't necessarily need a referral-based scheme to be able to find a person with relatively low skill.
Yeah, but who would this is fine. This is what we would expect. But this not, I mean, this is only half the story, right? The main story is here. This is exactly what you would expect. These guys are sitting in the village, and they are not very well educated. They don't have any particular training. They're aspiring, you know, the sort of realistic aspirations here in the job market are obviously at the lower end. Yeah, they're going to end up somewhere at the lower end or towards the bottom of this hierarchy. But that's not the interesting thing is here. So if you look at the percentage of these guys who are referred into the workplace, and people who are then at a similar level, it's a very, very tiny percentage of the people that employers rely on for recruitment here who are at the similar level, who are similar to those who come in, right? It's not the lower-end workers who... If it was the lower-end workers who shared information or spread information around, of course, this would be here. But this is not what you see. It's totally different. So your intuition here is taking you a little bit astray, maybe, or?
I don't quite see that, because in category 3, as an employer, I wouldn't need the referral program to find a suitable person to fill out a vacancy in category 3 or 2.
Well, that depends on what your problem is. So if you're happy to take anyone and they can go and leave and go and come and as whenever they want and it doesn't matter, then I agree with you. Yeah?
But the argument is that not all the people that are getting these referee jobs in category 1 may be qualified for them, right? No.
The argument here is about, so what type of people would you as an employer trust to act as a referee here, and a referee that then acts in according to your interests as the firm or as finding a recruit who we can then make sure perhaps shows up or behaves in a manner that is conducive to the firm's interest. Yeah? You may not agree. We have plenty of time to discuss it. Okay, how am I doing on time? I think I'm getting a little late already. Okay, so what we try to do here then is to look at these patterns that we observe, and there's going to be a bit more about patterns and other things, to see whether these various explanations for referral are consistent with what we observe or not. All right, so we sort of, it's a jigsaw approach to trying to understand what's going on in this labor market. It's going to worry people who care too much about sort of rigorous identification, but it may still provide some useful insights into what's really going on here, and that itself may have value for understanding. So if this information explanation was correct here, first of all, we would really sort of expect weak ties to be more important, because that would be easy. It would mean that people had access to a lot of information, and you could be recruited into in by someone who's not necessarily your close relative, in the manner that we've shown that matters here. You would also very much expect these referees, or the person who sort of help you in, to be in a similar type of job as yourself. That's also very different from what we observe. In terms of ability and wage predictions here, then I'm talking about wages in a similar type of job. So there's nothing particularly to be said about that. In terms of the screening explanation, this Montgomery explanation here, remember what we said here. It's about talented, productive, otherwise. So what you would sort of reasonably conjecture again that there's similarity between recruit and referee jobs, perhaps a little less strongly. But the main thing really here is about sort of what this says about the quality of the recruits, and then about the wages that you would observe in this labor market, which is different from our predictions, and as we should see, also different from what we find here. Sociality explanation, preference working together, again strong ties, could be friends as well, but strong ties would be expected. Similar referee recruit jobs, perhaps not that strong. Lower quality recruits possibly, and possibly a referral wage penalty. A little bit open on that, because it's not a clear sort of theoretical argument. Matching explanation, no ties, predicted similar referee recruit jobs, and again you would expect sort of a referral wage premium according to the theory. Nepotism, you would expect favoring relatives at expense of others, so that's consistent with the strong tie. No job difference prediction, lower quality recruits, if you get in lemons, and then you would also have a referral wage penalty. And again, for the sort of moral hazard part here, Kugler has no tie predictions, similar jobs here also. There's also an ability hint, so there's a wage premium, clear wage premium prediction here. This is very similar to Montgomery. So there's a moral hazard here that's actually very similar to the screening explanation. And as we know in economics, sometimes even if you have sort of seemingly very different types of theoretical explanations, the empirical predictions may not be distinguishable. And this is an example of that. So what we say here is strong ties, high-stake referee jobs, no ability difference for this to work. And then if it is the case that firms save, can pay a lower efficiency wage, then we expect the wage penalty. All right, so one thing that we did here, of course, and which is very important also in these labor markets, is to try to filter out ability concerns, right? So what you might have here, if you want to really sort of try to verify whether a type of recruit is more productive or are more able than others, you try to pin down a lot of different unobservables that you think matter in these labor markets. So we did that for a number of different candidate unobservables, but we also did a proxy Raven type test score. Many of you familiar with Raven tests? Or have any of you used Raven tests? So it's a proxy. It's a progressive matrix test. The main idea and the main argument here, and you can disagree with that, and I'm also a little skeptical in general, but the idea here is that these tests are claim to be neutral to educational exposure, which is why they can then also be used in developing country context. If you believe that, I see there's some smiles here, and I can share that smile myself. But essentially, so what we try to do here is to see whether there's any screening effect here. Yeah, so we have a Raven type test score or a top 10 test score, and if you do a simple regression here on these data, and you do it either without controls, get similar results, and there's absolutely no explanatory power here of this ability based on the performance test. So referral seemingly is not correlated with ability at all. So how do we know that this is relevant? Well, the interesting thing here is that we really find a very strong effect of the same measure on wages. So it matters in the labor market in terms of remuneration, but it doesn't matter here.
So you have different kinds of jobs, and then Raven's score may not be the kind of ability which Raven's score measures.
Yeah, absolutely.
May not be correlated with the kind of jobs that are being applied for. So this has got nothing to do with the predictive power per se.
Well, it depends on. So this matters a lot for wages in the same labor markets. So it clearly matters in the labor markets. So obviously we have different types of jobs. So we have to sort of, if you want to have data here, you have to live with that. What I'm saying is that this measure that we use for ability clearly matters also in these labor markets, and it matters very strongly for wages.
For a given job category,
wages
will be positively correlated with Raven's metric scores, right? For a given job category. But across job categories, it's not very clear, because this ability is not a predictor of the ability that is needed for doing well in that job.
No, I agree with your general sentiment here that this is not perfect, but then there is no perfect measure here. And if you wanted to have a perfect measure, you would have to sort of disaggregate it completely by job type, and then you would need a much larger data. So what we do find in terms of understanding, as a predictor of referral, you would also expect this to be a predictor of referral, if referral is a screening mechanism, right? And we don't find anything pointing in that direction. What we do find is that it's a strong predictor of wages in these same labor markets, in these same type of jobs, right? So that's at least interesting. Yeah.
So this Raven test scores, they are basically the kind of measure of cognitive, that type of cognitive ability.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So nothing related to type of social skills.
So we did a lot of stuff here, right? Because we knew that this was going to. So we asked people about their sort of, you know, whether they're handyman type of skills, right? Whether they're good at sorting out social problems, whether they are good at this, whether they're good at that, whether they, you know, or just simply, you know, sort of street smart, right? Jugaad, right? Do other people consider you to be a person with jugaad, you know? That could be a very valid.
Can you explain jugaad to the audience here?
Yeah, this is sort of. All the Indians know about this, obviously, but essentially, it's a local terminology to capture that somebody is street smart and clever to get the best out of whatever resources is available to them, which can of course, you know, in principle at least, be quite valuable in the labor market. Am I taking too long? I think so. So what we see here, okay, so we have this wage penalty prediction, and what we do here, if we use these different categories here and try to look for a threshold in wages where there's a difference between referred and non-referred workers, we find that only in these bottom tier jobs. Okay, so there's a very notable wedge there. So if there is a wage penalty, as our theory predicts, anywhere in this data set, it's into these category 3 jobs. All right. Labor turnover, same type of jobs. What you see here is that this is short-term turnover. Fraction of workers leaving before 6 months in job, if you're referred in, 0.2. If you're non-referred, 0.3. Average months in first job, higher here, are there. Both significant. There's a slight difference in numbers here because of some outliers. But there's certainly something going on here in terms of what referral does that is advantageous for employers. And then I have some regressions here, and some of you will squabble with that if you're... So what we've tried to do essentially is very simple. We've tried to set up something that is as close as possible to a Mincerian type of wage equation, and then we keep the same specification, and then we control for some of these. Here is that one I talked about, the entry wage and this top 10 Raven coefficient. And what we do here is to look at referral, the wage, then the turnover, and then the duration of work spell months. And you control for age, so that's experience, education, social group, main sector, destination dummies. We've added, we've done a lot of different specifications with other type of controls, including time trends and other stuff. And what we find here, sort of, we do observe this wage penalty that we predict. Yes, there are issues here that you all know about when it comes to potential endogeneity and so forth, but this is what we have. This is exactly, I mean, actually, if you look at the Munch and Rosenzweig paper in AER also, they have a referral variable in their regression, and nobody complained there. So this has been done before, and it's not unique. So what we sort of conclude from this is roughly as follows. So theory tailored for developing countries, since low and unskilled informal jobs dominate the occupational structure. Notice that this is important, obviously, if you haven't thought about it already. These strong tie networks, for this mechanism to work, strong tie networks have to be well placed to supply workers to the vacancies, right? And this is particularly plausible for when you have this type of occupational structure, since these are jobs that anyone in principle can do. If you think about a different occupational structure, the idea that strong tie networks overall would be able to perform a similar function would simply not work that well. There's limited scope for contract enforcement here, and especially at the lower end. These jobs are, as Blattmann and Durkon found to their surprise in Ethiopia, not always as attractive as they are thought to be, and that was for factory jobs. And the jobs we are looking at here are really sort of bottom-end jobs that are hard manual labor and often have very high turnover. So if turnover is a problem for you as an employer, okay, so you may say that, okay, so I need some guys here to do the dirty jobs right at the end. But I also want someone in here who is not going to, because if this person then leaves after a week, the job has to be done. So then I am going to have to assign someone else to do it. Or I may have to do it myself. I'm not interested in that. So I need someone to get in here who I can trust will stay on here and do this for as long as it goes. Okay, so it may seem to be a trivial problem sitting where we are, but for an employer, it can be a pretty tough everyday challenge. So it's easy to sort of overlook this and think that this is very easy, but it's not in my interpretation at least. The strenuous jobs with high turnover. So what we do here, we use non-experimental data, very unfashionable, but I do happen to believe that trying to study and understand real labor markets is more important and more valuable, even if it doesn't give you as clean results, than trying to understand sort of some constructed firm that somebody has bought to set up and where you try to run some experiments with people who are there on sort of clearly fairly fictitious terms and then present that as valuable insightful. I don't believe in it. I'd rather be compromised on the identification part. So what we observe here is same workplace, strong tie and high stake referee referrals. And it seems then, as we've seen, that this actually the entry into these first migrants jobs quite strongly filtered. Now, if you want to think about a little bit more about what this implies, then if it's sort of indicative, and of course we are not trying to generalize, make sweeping generalizations here, because we have a small sample. What we have done is to try to understand that sample as much as we can. And I do think there's something that squares with what I've seen more generally here, but I don't have the evidence to say. So, if this is indicative of how lower-end labor markets work, then there are some sort of important social mobility implications here. Because those of you familiar with Munch and Rosenzweig argue, of course, that there's sort of dynamic inefficiency, right? If new opportunities show up, it doesn't mean that there's large-scale response to it from everywhere, because people are, in a way, they're locked into the networks that they're part of and which can provide you with the advantages that networks then offer. And if you're going to go into some other part or other place, then that's going to be much harder in terms of finding work. So what happens here, of course, if you have this kind of persistence that we showed in these migration maps also, is that group predicaments become sort of interlocked with whatever good or bad luck that happens to the part of the labor market or the type of jobs that you tend to be happen to be clustered in. I'm done. Okay, so this is important because it means that outcomes here in the long term really are sort of determined by a lot of things that are very concentrated and much less general than what you would have if people just moved freely around and responded to incentives as they showed up. So what we seem to have here, what I would say we have probably here, is then a coexistence of the high-skilled modern labor market alongside other labor markets, where these particular concerns are much more prevalent, and I think we need to think more about those kind of issues. All right, I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, we are running out of time, but maybe question from the visiting fellows, that they, most of them are live today.
No,
maybe
no,
they
sir.
Felt
no,
a little bit intimidated so far, but
no.
Now is your opportunity.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think the report has been saying that for the higher skilled workers, their referred and non-referred wages are, I mean, the difference is insignificant.
Which one? The
So this is sort of I'm just thinking out loud. So
No, that's fine. Yeah, it's a lot.
Because they are better skilled, and they have more skill than rest of the work, and a majority of the workforce. Because in India, about 86 to 87% of the people are informally employed.
Yeah.
So the demand for a higher skilled job is less. From an employer, the demand is less. A, that could be the case. B, because even if they refer somebody for a particular job, there are more criteria that need to be met for a formal sector job, right? Higher skilled job.
Yeah.
So in that case, being referred or being non-referred would anyway not make a difference, right? I'm sort of thinking that could this be an explanation for the result that we see there?
That there's no wage penalty there?
Yeah,
it's also this referral mechanism. It's not clear that it applies that it's equally effective across all type of jobs, right? Because what it means essentially is that you also have to then sort of buy into this idea that, you know, the sort of strong. I mean, I've been recruited by my relative here, and I better perform. It's not necessarily clear that applies across the board, that buying into that works in that manner. But also it is surprising. I mean, I agree with you. I would expect this to be observable in other jobs as well. And we don't have a clear explanation for why it doesn't. But I mean, the thing about all these theories is, of course, that there may be other things going on that we haven't thought about, and that explains this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, no, don't ask me too difficult questions. No. That was a good question. So, yeah.
So again, when it comes to networking, so in at least in, I mean, in any case, networking more often falls on, like, it's a part of, say, social capital, if you talk about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is anecdotal, completely anecdotal. So there are ghost villages in the state of Uttarakhand in India.
Hmm.
So what I know, because I belong to that state, what I know is that the migration, the villages after villages migrate because, again, there is this high social capital. And that is irrespective of the skill level of people. Because, they have faith that once they migrate to an urban area, they will figure out something because they already have people there. So you need a few people to migrate, then because there are networks, on
yeah.
their faith, other people migrate.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
now those villages are entirely empty. There's nobody living there. But that's also because there is this demand for informal sector workers in urban areas.
Mm.
So what we've seen in India is that over the past few years, contract workers or short-term contract workers are increasing.
Yeah, I know.
So
yeah.
again, that creates this casual workers. So
mm.
that creates this demand for such workers, and
mm.
that could probably explain this regional migration that we see
in the map.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, the thing here is that. So what Kaivan Munshi talks about is in one of his papers is this idea of a bridgehead, right? So you need to sort of, so what you do if migration works in this manner, you need to first establish a bridgehead, and then the sort of there is accumulation of that network. Now, one thing that we looked at some point here, this unrelated to this, is about different business communities in India and how they sort of assemble and how they concentrate and so forth. So if you look at part of the Gujarati business community, for instance, if you can sort of say something as broad as the Gujarati business community, it's a bit too simple. But if you compare those with sort of Marwaris, for instance, what you have is that you have much stronger concentration, for instance, in Mumbai, right? These Marwaris are everywhere, almost. That's exaggerated too, because they're not everywhere, but they are in many more places than Gujaratis are. And obviously there's sort of some other dynamic there in terms of how important this sort of network at destination is seen to be. What we find here, if you look at this over a little more time, is that for some of these Ansaris, for instance, they have transformed. As community, they used to be sort of weavers. Now they are bakery people. And they've been running, they started running bakeries in eastern India, in some of the industrial towns in eastern India. Then those industries that they relied upon for workers, and customers for the bakeries went down, so they had to move. And then they've sort of been moving to different parts. And now they're instead in Maharashtra mainly. So starting with eastern India, West Bengal, and Bihar, and now Jharkhand, where they are now is in sort of Pune and Mumbai, they're much larger. So there is a dynamic here in change, but the problem with these networks still is that this change takes much longer to sort of instigate and then have a sort of transformation than what you would have if you think about migration as sort of individuals responding to incentives here and there. So obviously when the network starts changing, then there will be some calculations about what's better here and so forth, and then you'd establish a new bridgehead on the basis of that.
Okay, so we conclude this seminar here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.